1935, the Lions win the NFL championship. The Detroit Tigers take the World Series. The Red Wings bring home Lord Stanley's Cup. Joe Louis begins his rise to world domination. This transforms the Motor City into Detroit, City of Champions.
All right, that's the sound of my slice is what that is. It's Detroit, City of Champions, the podcast. I'm Jamie Flanagan.
Charles Avison.
And we're in the palatial podcast, Your Voice.
It's a great studio.
Yeah, the studio is here.
You said that somewhat sarcastically.
Berkeley, Southfield.
But I don't think it's sarcastic at all. I love this studio. It's great.
I do too. I do too.
Okay, good. I thought I hinted some sarcasm in your voice.
More and more shows starting all the time. People wanting to podcast their voices.
Great. So, that's fantastic.
Podcastyourvoice.com, cityofchampions.com, and then there's a link tree, and you can go to all the places like Spotify and Google Podcast, and wherever you're listening, like, subscribe, leave a comment, and then most importantly, appreciate it. Tell a couple friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Share it with somebody, and then because they're great stories. I tell you, I'm like becoming the advocate every time. I was like down in Florida helping my mom get situated into assisted living, and she's 90, and so we're again, and every time I'm talking to somebody, a different handyman comes over, or you know, just whatever. People buying, we're selling furniture and stuff. People coming over to buy furniture. I'm like handing them the City of Champions cards. It's like, hey,
yeah, you got the flyers
out
for the show, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because I hand them out all day too. I'm at the mall, so I hand them out all the time.
New fans tuning in.
Yeah.
So if you're just finding us, there's lots of stories that are happening. We're in the middle of golf. We're talking about my
Walter
slice.
Walter Hagen,
but we've talked the Wings and the Tigers and the Lions, and then
well,
Joe
I think
Louis,
a lot of these stories, like especially Garwood, like the story we're going to be talking about today, even if you're not necessarily like a Detroit sports fan,
mm-hmm.
this is an era where these stories are intersecting with the evolution of the sports that we are talking about.
Yeah.
So I mean, all these different sports, we started at the beginning with like hockey and boxing and football. I mean, we didn't really go to the beginnings of baseball, which I have a feeling we'll get to when we come sort of full circle around.
Yes,
that's a whole nother world. But if we were talking about the origins of baseball, we'd still be talking about baseball,
right? Yeah.
You know, that's what I'm saying, though, is it's kind of interesting. I think it's kind of interesting. That's why it's even if you're not necessarily a Detroit sports fan,
right?
This isn't, you know, I just think that we, like I say, we intersect with the story of these sports, like Detroit sports of this era intersects with all of these, with the evolution of these sports themselves.
I'm not a sports guy at all in any way, shape, or form, but I love Detroit and I love history, and then just these stories and the way that you tell them and the information that you found just excites me.
Well, I appreciate that. And the thing I think for me, a lot of this history, you know, I've said before, like one of my fascinations about history is the idea that you can take something from the past and there's the well-worn saying, which is like, if you don't understand history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I've said before, the more optimistic flip side of that saying, which is, if you understand what people in the past did, you know, the successes they had, then you can stand on their shoulders and build upon those successes.
Hopefully,
and reach for something bigger.
Because we could use a little history repeating with this kind of history.
Well, sure.
Because we haven't had a ton of positivity since.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. Exactly. Yeah, that's where the optimistic history, you know, that's where that optimistic perspective comes in. And so, the first step is to understand it. And that's what, I haven't really talked about this idea, but one of my favorite things about like sort of like trying to, you know, reading about history and studying history is there's always motivations why things turned out the way they did. It's not a lot of times that things just evolve because they just did.
Right.
Like there's always sort of a reason why, you know, and even the most mundane things that you never even would think about exploring,
mm-hmm.
there's a reason why they are the way that they are. There was like a person that was trying to cheat at something or whatever, and then so they had to put a rule down. The you know, there's always something that led to it. And if in it, the more of those sort of pieces you can put together to form the story of the, you know, of how things became the way they are, that's when you can build that foundation upon which to stand, upon which to reach up. And so that's why, you know, when we're talking, we're talking about Walter Hagen, and that what I just said there could apply to really all the sports. But in today's episode, I really think that this is a huge example of what I just said.
And it's a unique historical perspective on what's happening.
Yes. Well, today, this is something I was actually looking around on the internet because we're talking about how World War I impacted professional golf. And literally, Walter Hagen is the only one that talks about this. I mean, I'm not going to try to say that there's no, like, maybe there's somewhere on somebody, you know, somebody in some other book that wrote just a general history of pro golf.
Sure.
You know, again, we're not saying that this is the definitive guide to golf history by any means. But when you do a search for World War I impact on professional golf, I just didn't see anything.
Right.
Like, there's, you know, like, there's just not, like, if that's a subject you're interested in or even looking for any information, like, as far as I can see, you know, just from my, you know, sort of cursory search today, you know, when I was kind of putting all this together, you're not going to see anything about this, about the topic we're talking about and what the, because this was what, like, what Walter Hagen is talking about in his book and the intersection of World War I is, like, you know, I wrote about it in my book, of course, I covered it in this, but on a, like, sort of like on a second look, like, you know, using this show to be able to, you know, hyper focus on one particular component of a story allows you to kind of marvel at what about just how significant that little element is. And again, so that's what we're, you know, that's what we're talking about today is this intersection, this how World War I was just monumentally, it wasn't necessarily just the war itself, but the events of World War I and what these golfers in America were doing at the time and how it was kind of like in like just indirectly, like they weren't even trying to do what ended up happening, but what ended up happening was profound, was incredibly, I mean, you could almost say it's like one of the most important things to happen to golf. And it happened just like during World War I as a result of these guys doing what they were doing. So
So World War I starts raging in 1914. And things are still kind of cool here in
America. As Walter Hagen is finishing up his, you know, he's won the 1914 U.S. Open. So that's so that World War I in Europe is just about to begin. And World War I is one of my favorite subjects.
Oh.
I've been studying World War I since I can even, I'm old enough to like remember.
Yeah.
Like it's one of my favorite, if like there's, I just found this phenomenal BBC. I watch everything I can find on World War I. I've read every book I can find.
Yeah.
I have, I've been to the there's a museum. There's an Imperial War Museum in London, which I've been to specifically because of their World War I exhibit.
Wow. Okay.
World War I is probably one of my top five subjects that that I'm like, you know, not only interested in but just, you know, well versed as far as information in that.
Tangent time. The movie Kingsman. So the third one goes back to their
that's what I heard,
origins. And so you haven't seen it?
I have not seen it.
Okay.
No.
I was curious what your impression was.
I have not seen that specific movie, but I haven't seen any of them.
Okay.
And so that's one of the things I've been wanting to,
Those are fun. The first one's great. The second one's all right.
Yeah.
You know, and the third one, you know, it I was like, there's a point in the movie you're like, holy crap, how do they recover from this?
Yeah.
It was like halfway through the movie, I'm like, you didn't just do that. Did not just happen.
Yeah.
How do you finish this movie? And it's like, but they did. So.
No, it's on my bucket list of stuff, of movies to watch, just because that, like, I mean, like, even if it's just a random scene, like in Wonder Woman, there was a scene of her in the trenches.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that was one of the only reasons I even watched Wonder Woman was because I wanted to see the, you know, what led up to that moment in the trenches. Like, that's how much World War I history is, like, some of my favorite. It's, and just as, like I say, just real quick, there's a, on YouTube, there is a show. And it is it's a BBC show from 1964 about World War I. It's a series, and there's a black and white, and there's a they actually colorized it.
Oh wow!
anyone that is interested in World War One is it's the best documentary I've ever seen. I just watched it this year, and like they actually have. Like, this is because it was made in 1964. They're only 40 years removed from the events.
Yeah.
And so they actually have people from the moments that they're talking about. Sure. That, like, the leaders, like, the you know, the generals and everybody that was involved in the decision making are there, like, on camera talking about it. Like, it's like a World War II documentary where you have, like, the bomber pilot captain. That's who's there in, you know, talking about these shows. It is one of the best, not just World War One documentaries I've ever seen, but just one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. I think it's just called World War One, but it was the BBC series from 1964. It's really,
the
really
BBC
good.
BBC does good work.
Yeah, no,
so,
they do.
All right, so you really dig the World War One history, and Walter Hagen had, like we said, just won the U.S. Open.
At the moment that really World War One is breaking out.
Right.
You know, so... And so it's at this moment that, you know, basically, you know, the thing about World War One was initially it's just almost like every other war.
Yeah.
Initially, like, all the sides think that this is about to be a quick war. Mm-hmm. It's a glorious war. Let's go off and, you know, become, you know, live this, like, you know, this heroic, you know, life for, you know, everyone was in a big rush to get there because they didn't want to miss it because it was going to be over so fast. Exactly. So the first waves that went in, there was no trenches when they first went in. Yeah. And, you know, and it's interesting when you're looking at it to see how it happened, which was both sides locked up. You know, there was, you know, Germans advanced massively at first, but both sides eventually, especially when the British landed on, you know, into France and that, they locked, both sides locked up, and then they just tried to outflank each other all the way to the coast until there was no more room to outflank. And then at that point is when they started to really dig in because the other side was trying to launch massive attacks in their direction. Yeah. And so like the trenches came all the way back. Like they, you know, the trenches systems crossed all of Europe, and you're like, when you watch the war, like the battle, you know, the battle fronts become established, like when you see it, like, and that's when you're just like, oh god, something really bad is coming.
Yeah,
you know, when you, especially when you're watching the documentaries or reading the books. And so anyway, so in early, so 1914, these people are thinking, well, this is just a, you know, European conflict, but, you know, it's gonna be over quick.
Yeah,
it's no big deal. So they don't see that coming. So Walter Hagen, like, in the U.S. doesn't get involved till 1917 either, and in any case, so just to kind of take you through what, you know, Walter's experience in 1914, he wins the U.S. Open. He becomes famous for winning the U.S. Open. This is his first, like, glimpse in fame. He quits baseball, as we were talking about.
Yeah.
Baseball is in his rearview mirror. And so, and then in the winter of 1914, 1915, Hagen, there's one of the guys from the tour, this guy named Jim Barnes, who's like a famous, he's been like a pro golfer for like 9 years. He makes friends with this guy. And Jim Barnes invites him out to sort of some of these clubs, some of these, like, because he's like kind of like how Hagen, like, his home club was in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he was like the club pro of Rochester. Jim Barnes was a club pro of, okay, I think it was a couple different golf clubs out in the Northwest. So, like, in San Francisco and Washington.
Oh.
So this was like and there's also a big tournament there called the Panama Exposition Championship in San Francisco at it's called the Ingleside Club in San Francisco. So Jim Barnes, like, come on out to my home clubs, and you can, you know, it'll be like kind of like, we're bringing a U.S. Open star out here, and we're gonna, you know, it's a good, you know, it's an opportunity for you to build your name out here on the other side of the country. And so they did. And so Walter Hagen comes out to this area, plays a couple of these different clubs, and he wins this Panama Exposition Championship, and he wins the first ever $1,000 prize. Ooh. In golf history. $1,000.
Boom goes the dynamite.
$1,000. And you could say, well, you know, $1,000 would be worth like $1 million today. No, it wasn't.
No, it wasn't.
$1,000, you know, it's worth more than it is today, but it wasn't. The interesting thing is that it shows you, like, golf was not financially anywhere near as lucrative as it was, you know, as it is today. And that's what we're going to see is this.
About 30,000.
About 30, 30 grand he wins. And so he's even talking about it here. He's like, I had $1,000. It was, you know, good, you know, it was good money to live off of for like a month or two. You know, I mean, that's what he survived on. So he was like, I had $1,000 that I had won. It allowed us to kind of live, you know, like, you know, pretty decent lifestyle for the minute.
Yeah.
Because they just won this tournament. But he's got this kind of great story. And I was telling you a story after the after one of the shows recently, and you're like, why didn't you put that on the show? Because we didn't talk about it. You're like, that's a great little story. And yeah. I'm like, well, it didn't really have anything to do with the main narrative. And I was like, so I'm going to start, we're going to throw some of these in there because it's like some color, you know?
Yeah.
So this doesn't have anything to do really with, you know, the story we're trying to tell today, but it's some color, and it kind of shows you the kind of life that Walter Hagen's living as we progress through his story.
All right, he's got that 30 grand in his pocket.
30 grand in his pocket,
ready
yeah.
to blow it.
Yeah, so...
He likes the ladies.
Yeah, so... Oh, he does. Hagen loves the ladies, yeah. So he's talking about how they got this thousand and stuff. So, but anyways, so they're in San Francisco. So he says, I was getting a big kick out of all the traveling golf afforded me. San Francisco is one of the cities I'll never forget. It was a tough place. The Barbary Coast had an international reputation. During the Exposition Championship matches, Carl Anderson and I took in the sights and wound up in a nightclub where the entertainment convinced us the operators were paying well for police protection. As we were leaving the joint, I was a couple of stairs above Carl when a man dashed up past me and grabbed for the door. A bullet whizzed too close to my neck, and the guy dropped on the top step. I hurtled his body rolling down the steps, and neither Bannister nor Landy could have caught Carl and me as we got out of the place and sprinted up the steep hill to safer ground. I read the next day that the murder we witnessed was the 28th committed in the Barbary Coast area that month. That month, jeez. So he saw a guy get
murdered. What is this?
No, this is Barbary Coast, San Francisco, in 1914, you know, in the winter of 1914.
Jeez.
So, yeah, but he actually just keeps on going. That $1,000 prize money put me financially sound for the rest of the tour. So I mean, he kind of keeps talking about it. But anyways, so that's what he's doing, and you know, shortly thereafter, and his next little thing that happens at this exact same moment is that AJ Spaulding, which Spaulding was the biggest, sporting goods manufacturer.
Name's still out there today.
Totally, yeah. Hagen signed a contract to exclusively use Spaulding golf balls.
Oh, nice.
From like then on, you know, at least for a while. So like a new, so that was his. So now he's like officially a big name because
but
Spaulding
it was all Puma tennis shoes for him though.
Was that?
It was all, yeah. No. He was a Puma guy.
No, is that, did like, you see that somewhere?
No,
I missed
kidding,
that.
No,
okay, good.
Because
I missed that.
No,
yeah.
No.
But they, so now, you know, Hagen's like an officially a big name because now it's like Walter Hagen uses Spaulding golf balls.
Jeez.
You know, like that's appearing in all the catalogs.
Yeah.
So Hagen's now is a big name. So. And so the next sort of couple little components just to kind of move the narrative along. 1915 U.S. Open, a guy named Jerry Travers is an amateur. He wins the U.S. Open in 1915.
Oh, good for him.
Hagen finishes 10th. 1916 U.S. Open, a guy named Chick Evans, who's an amateur, wins, the next one's in Minnesota.
Do they call him Chicky Baby?
Probably.
Yeah. Hey,
I would imagine.
Baby.
So, like, what else would
in
you call him?
In the 1919.
What else would you call him?
It's
probably
baby.
Charles. I think Chick was another name where people called him. You know, he went from Chick or Charles to Chuck to Chick. So Hagen finished 7th, but there was another amateur that won. So there's all these amateurs that are winning, you know, going all the way back to We Met.
But then the line between what is amateur, because today you say amateur, it's a slightly different connotation than these amateurs.
Well, these amateurs are, I don't think
and
they're
pro
getting...
and amateur. Today is different than pro and amateur then.
Well, I mean, these guys, the amateurs are winning tournaments back then, you know. I mean, I just don't know. They're just not pros, like making a ton of money like Hagen and them, you know.
Yeah.
But Hagen
they're
even mentions
level.
It.
I mean, today amateurs are people who are like just, you know, cutting their teeth and busting their chops. Back then, the amateurs were guys that were like really, really good, but didn't play as often as the pros.
Well, I think the difference is that the amateurs today, like once you get to past like 18, if you're going to keep on progressing in golf, you're just going to become a pro. Like there's not. Whereas back then, you would like keep your amateur status and keep playing because you probably had somebody financing you. You probably had some money coming from some other sources that you could afford the luck because it's one of the themes that we're going to be kind of, you know, that's, you know, the prevailing narrative of this entire Hagen story is that there is a sort of a genteel reputation like that amateurs enjoy that professionals do not.
Right.
Professionals are viewed as like basically dirty mercenaries.
Right.
They
may
enjoy watching these guys play golf, but you know, but they're not, but they're basically like, you know, they're basically like you know, they're hustlers. You know, they're looked at as like pool sharks and hustlers. They're not viewed as like the gentlemen of the game, like the amateurs are. Yeah. And so the amateurs can go into the clubhouse. Amateurs can meet with the big shots. They can get, you know, jobs in high placed industries because they're allowed to go in and sip high balls in the after hours, exactly. You know, in the 19th green, you yep. know, the 19th hole. So. Yeah. So there's a certain – so they may not make the same money as the pros, which pros get to actually – you know, actually – and they're not necessarily making a ton of money anyways. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's almost like – you almost – it's almost like why would you kind of want to become a pro? Because if you're an amateur, you can enjoy all the fringe benefits yeah. of like – you know, of like the perks that come with meeting the right people and all, and being part of the right social circles. Whereas if you're a pro – yeah, you get to do whatever you want to make money, but the money is not anywhere near, right, you know. Right. So I think that's the trade-off. I think yeah. that was the trade-off at that moment. So anyway, so 1915, 16, you know, as we're you know, saying here that this is the years that World War One is starting to rage.
Yeah.
And so Hagen in 1916 doesn't win the Open, as we mentioned, he finished 7th, but he did win the two next biggest tournaments, which there was a tournament called the Western Open, which was in Milwaukee, and in another tournament called the Metropolitan Open, which is in Long Island. And so he won both of those. And so those were not like they were not majors. They weren't the, you know, U.S. Opens, but those were two other big tournaments, and he won both of those. According to Hagen, by 1916, World War One is raging, of course. Mm-hmm. Not just according to Hagen, but according to everyone, World War One is raging. But according to him, he talks about how the British golfers are, you know, they're all part of the war effort. And he's like, they were tremendously missed at this moment because the shine that they brought from traveling over to America to be part of these U.S. Opens yeah. is completely gone. And wow. so they're yeah. just, they're existing completely off American star power in golf, which is, you know, limited. You know, he's like one of the biggest names now. And he's sure. like, I'm the biggest guy in golf. And, you know, we didn't have these stars from like the We Met days.
Right.
And so anyways... it's at this moment that and this is where we're getting into this to the story here, the story that we want to tell. So what's interesting is that the U.S. Golf Association, they're like, you know, even though the America at this point is not involved with the war, let's do something to help. You know, let's do something to like, you know, whether they, you know, they, you know, it sounds like they genuinely wanted to help. So they wanted to. So what they decided to do was to play these exhibition games for the Red Cross, to raise money for the Red Cross.
Okay.
And what's interesting is, this is what we're going to see here, that these exhibitions that they're about to do for the Red Cross are about to change golf forever.
Okay.
And that's what's so interesting is, it's like, you know, Hagen doesn't go into the motivation of it. It sounds like they generally wanted to help and raise yeah. money for the Red Cross.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's people were chipping in and...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what's interesting is that what we're going to show here is that like them just like trying to do, you know, do good and, you know, be helpful is going to completely change like golf.
Oh.
And this is like one of the things that, like, you know, even this, you know, back to the beginning we were saying, even if you're not necessarily interested in Detroit sports, like if you're just interested in golf history, like yeah. where else are you going to hear this story? And this is right from right from Walter Hagen's mouth. All so right. And he was part of it. So and this again is from Walter Hagen's book, but, you know, by the Hague himself. So World War One had ended golf for British players, and we were beginning to feel the effects over here. H.B. Martin suggested a plan for our golfers to raise money for the Red Cross, and the idea was sponsored by the Professional Golfers Association. Exhibitions were arranged for various clubs in the East, and individual golfers with strong drawing power were scheduled to play. Members of the clubs bid at auction for the privilege of caddying for their favorite pro, and the balls were also auctioned off at the end of each match. Admission was charged for the matches, and all money derived given to the Red Cross. Those war years brought in more money through golf than we'd ever dreamed could be made. This was, in fact, the beginning of admission charges to golf championships, both amateur and professional. While all this money went to war relief agencies, it did prove that hundreds of golf spectators would pay just to follow their favorite golfers around the course. Spectators grew to like the idea of paying admission, of having the matches staged and the crowds controlled. Thus, the championships could be planned for better viewing for the gallery and for better and more comfortable play by the competing golfers. Charging admissions for the big matches gave the clubs the cash to keep the greens and fairways in good playing condition, helped build more and higher prizes for the golfers, and kept the association going strong with deposits in the treasury. The USGA made the plans and the suggestions, while the member clubs organized their rosters into crews to man the ropes, teach the galleries tournament etiquette, and collect the gate receipts. This is the key sort of like emphasis, like paragraph here.
Mm-hmm.
Before the war, prizes were made up from the contributions of the club members into a kitty to pay the pros and finance the meet. So all the money for the tournaments, the $1,000 he made at this, at the exposition, were because these were just passing the hat around the golf members.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But now, when they're charging admission for fans to come watch,
right,
they got a way bigger, because they can pass the hat if they want, sure, still. But now they open it up for selling tickets to, mm-hmm, for fans to come in and watch the games. And now they got a bucket they get to pass around, let alone a little hat. So the dollar admission tickets for the Red Cross educated both the gallery and the club to potentials of gate receipts. Gate receipts open an entirely new financial setup for the professional golfer. We eventually began to receive increasingly higher fees for our exhibitions based upon the appeal and power of the individual to bring in the crowds. Why did I play for the galleries? Why did I dramatize my game? Because I was one of the first to realize that golf could pay big for the gallery if the gallery came to see me, win or lose. For as I said earlier, all tickets were the same price regardless of where the fans' sympathies lay. I intended to be a drawing card as long as I stayed in the game. And the way it looked to me, I'd be in there for a good long time. So he was, if you remember, we were talking about in the previous show, how there was like, there people would accuse him of playing up for the crowds.
Sure, yeah.
And so he's like, why did I dramatize my game? Because I was one of the first to realize that golf could pay big if the gallery came to pay tickets to see me. Like, that's that seems so obvious. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Like, you're sitting there going, imagine you're going to somebody and you're talking about golf history, and you go, when did golf start charging fans admission to watch the games? And they're going, people would go, when didn't they charge admission to watch the games? That seems so obvious. Like, if baseball is charging admission and football is charging admission and all these sports are charging admission, why wouldn't golf have charged admission? Because they're country clubs. Because they're amateurs. This is an amateur. The golf clubs aren't even letting pros come into their courses. They're not going to sell tickets to the I was going to try to find a nicer word, but riffraff will work.
Common man.
Yeah, to the hoi polloi.
Yeah.
I got that off the Three Stooges. Like, they're not going to, you know, so the golf clubs, they're not professional clubs. These are genteel amateur associations. If you're going to allow fans to come in and watch your things, I'm sure they would open it up. Like the We Met game, the greatest game ever, there was a big thing. They wanted to bring some attention. Sure, they let some fans in.
Yeah.
But they weren't going to charge him admission.
No.
They're not mercenaries.
Dirty. That's dirty.
Exactly, that's dirty. So that's what I'm saying is, what's interesting here is that now the golf clubs themselves are evolving from amateurism into professionalism.
Sure.
You see? This is a massive change for golf.
That is a big shift.
Exactly. So now they're like, well, hell.
We could be an industry like baseball or football.
Yes. Yes. That's a monumental shift. And it happened because they were raise money for the Red Cross.
Right.
And the money that was coming in for the Red Cross, they go, God damn, look how much Walter Hagen talks about in here. Listen to this. He said, this is right after he was talking about the, you know, same quote, really. I was invited to play in most of these exhibitions and this helped build my reputation as a golfer. Although these Red Cross exhibitions at first included only the professionals, the schedules were later arranged to bring in outstanding amateurs. During the years the matches were played, we raised more than $1.25 million for war relief. He just talked about that tournament was the first U.S. golfer in 1914, winner of 1914, for $1,000 prize.
So they brought in.
And you're talking about a year or so later, they brought in a million, what do you say, $1.25 million for world relief. Listen to this. I was proud that $125,000 was the direct result of my own efforts. He raised $125,000. You're talking about a couple years. you know, a couple of years of doing these exhibitions for the Red Cross, because he's talking about by 1916, 17, you know, is when they're, you know, is the, you know, the time frame he's talking about here. So he we're
it's
talking
like
about
$29 million.
Yeah. So that's what they're saying. They're going, uh-huh. Well, hell, if we raised a $1.25 million for the Red Cross, why don't we do this for, when the war is over? Let's do this for ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a massive change. So like that it gave us the confidence to go that people would pay money to watch us play, and the golf clubs are like, golly, you know, like imagine you're these golf clubs, you're going, we are the genteel amateur We refuse to take any revenue. And then they start raising money for the Red Cross, and they got sacks, you know, they got hay bales full of cash that they're going, you know, the Red Cross is stopping by and they're stuffing in the back of these Red Cross vans, and these golf country club guys are going, oh God, like that'd be nice for us to keep one of those. Maybe we should keep one of those hay bales of money for ourselves. It goes, or
doctor up the greens.
Yeah, or after this war is over, we can start keeping all the hay bales for ourselves. Yeah. You know? So anyway, that's what I'm saying. So this is a huge change. Mm-hmm. And it happens because, you know, they're trying to do this charity thing, and now all of a sudden, golf is taking the next, is leveling up. It's going to the next, it's entirely. So as soon as you start bringing in more money, that's when everything starts to change.
Sure.
So anyway, so that's like really the core component of this, is that, you know, is this, you know, if you know, sort of what I was just saying, if somebody comes up and goes, when did golf start charging admission to the fans coming into the games? You'd be thinking like, when didn't they do that?
Right.
Because that's so obvious. But it wasn't obvious. It wasn't the case. And that demarcation of when that started to happen was during World War One, when they were raising money for the Red Cross, mm-hmm. and it's a definitive moment in the history of the game. And so I just think it's a fascinating component. And Hagen certainly spends enough time on it in his autobiography to talk about it. So that's a couple other things that happened sort of during this time with regards to Hagen. He got married in 1917.
Aww.
And then divorced in 1921. But in between, in 1918, he had a son, Walter Jr., with a lady named Margaret Johnson. And so in 1917, of course, the U.S. entered World War I. Hagen tried to enlist in the Air Force, but what they denied him because he was raising so much money for the Red Cross. They were like, you're doing your part. Yeah. You're doing so well with the Red Cross. I mean, he's like the number one golfer.
Right.
And they're like, you're raising so much money that like it'd be a waste.
How
for
about
us.
You go golf?
Yeah. You just go golf.
How about you go?
We'll take it from here.
sell some bonds and raise some money.
Exactly. So,
So
because he even said, he was like, I wanted to, you know, enlist, but, you know, he raised $125,000 by himself.
Wow.
They're like, you know, but it's insane when you compare that measly $1,000. That was the big first golfer ever to make $1,000. They're like, I made $1,000. And then just a few years later,
rolling in a
crushing,
million.
Crushing,
yeah.
Like, say, bales of cash.
Whew.
So, anyways, yeah, so this is, you know, that's where we're at. This is, you know, it's pretty much all I got for today.
So there's a new golf league. There's a new golf. So you got the PGA, but there's a new one out of like in the Middle East, right?
Oh yeah, Live Golf. Yeah,
yeah, that Live Golf.
Yeah,
and people are like, oh yeah, well if you're gonna play Live Golf, go play the Live Golf.
Yeah,
you know, don't be on the PGA.
Yeah, come on.
You know, but so today. Somebody, there's a guy who's like one of the guys that's doing both and playing Live Golf, and he was playing, and one of the PGA players, like, he was the guy's like on the green, like down, lining up his putt, walks right across his line.
Really?
I mean, you don't even do that. You don't even do that in putt-putt. You know?
Yeah, are you kidding me?
Right on TV. Right.
Oh, my God.
Trampled right through. Yeah, it was great.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man.
Well, it's
the guy like lining up his putt was just like, did that just happen?
Oh, my
you know?
God. So, yeah. So he did it on purpose.
Oh, it's my like God, this, yeah. Oh.
Come on, dude. That's
purpose.
So basic,
oh,
dude.
My God. It was great. I thought it was fantastic.
Well, no. Wait, you don't like the Live Golf?
Ah.
Why? What's wrong with the Live Golf?
Pick one.
No, but why is that? I mean, it's capitalism. It's competition. And from what I understand, like, I mean, you've got the PGA Tour, Why do you get an automatic monopoly in this world to say you're not allowed to compete in any other tournament. You have to be on the PGA Tour.
You're talking to the guy still hanging onto his MySpace page, though.
Okay, I got an old MySpace. I don't really log in very often.
I'm just saying,
competition improves everything because what it means the PGA has to raise their game. They can't. You know, I'm not the most knowledgeable when it comes to all the ins and outs, but I've heard that there's a ton of problems that I am familiar with baseball, of course, and all the issues that come away from, when Major League Baseball has a monopoly on baseball, the decisions, the problem is that when you have no competing league, what happens is that the main league that's in charge of everything you have incredibly ridiculous, terrible decisions that are made, and there's no consequences. The game goes into the crapper, and there's nobody that's there's nobody that's there to challenge those terrible decisions that are there because you have a monopoly, you don't have to face against anybody. Your league goes down the crapper, but you don't have to face any real consequences because it's a slow decline, like what's happening to baseball right now.
Well, it's interesting that in hockey and in basketball, there's leagues in other countries, but it's usually people that are waning or fading. In the NBA, they'll go to these secondary things.
But all those major leagues don't even have any competition, really. The NBA doesn't have any competition, really.
Right.
The NHL really doesn't have much competition.
And usually these are waning and fading players.
And
so, but golf, these are the starting lineup. This is the A-team.
Well, it's the first time we've seen one of these major professional leagues that are being challenged by an outside league trying to knock them off the peg.
The thing is money.
But here's the thing:
so much money to throw at
Major League Baseball back in 1901. Yeah. There was that everybody looks at Major League Baseball today as one giant juggernaut. Okay, back in the late 1800s, the way that we look at Major League Baseball today, that was the National League.
Right.
It was the National League. And the American League was born out of the Western League, which was a smaller independent league. And so there's a guy named Ben Johnson who came along and said, I'm going to take my supposedly inferior league and I'm going to make them into a major league. And I'm going to challenge the National League for dominance in the world of professional baseball because I can do it better.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. And so he challenged. So the American League was born literally as a challenge against the National League. Mm-hmm. And they were kicking their butts up and down the field. Half their players were coming to the American League. They were paying them great money. They were establishing teams in the cities of the National League. That's why there was two teams in Chicago. That's why there's two teams in New York. They were establishing teams in the same city saying, we're about to kick your butts up and down the court. And so there was a war between the National American League. And so they got to the point where the National League goes, they're like, you know what? We give up. Let's make something out of this where we challenge each other for we'll call it the World Series. Right? And so the World Series was born out of this competition between the National American League. They were two distinct leagues.
Right.
Until the American League established itself through warfare with that other league, saying we are here to challenge your previous supremacy. And then what happened as a result? Major League Baseball from 1901 going forward became like this massive sport. That was the golden era. It was the early 1900s all the way up through. Through the 1960s, that was the golden era of baseball. And that's what I'm saying is that out of that initial conflict emerged a unified action, which because the National League, the American League brought all kinds of new ideas to the table. That's why they were kicking their butts up and down the floor. But that's what I'm saying is that if you just have one league that just gets a natural supremacy, a natural dominance, then there's nothing ever evolves necessarily. Yeah. It doesn't because they don't have to.
Right.
They're just the natural dominance. But the competition, whether it's in sports or whether it's in business or whether it's in anywhere else, when you just manipulate the situation because you're the most dominant, then everything starts to decline and fall apart in a row.
There should be a podcast about that.
Oh, there should, yeah. Well, we got our baseball thing going. We can start exploding that, yeah. So, but it's the same concept. Yeah, like,
I just thought it was funny that how the players are kind of digging at each other.
Oh, they are, sure. Sure they are. But the same thing happened in 1901 with the American League versus the National League in baseball. Yeah. You had guys that are calling each other traitors and all this. Oh, you're a traitor. You're going to the American League.
Yeah.
And now the American League and National League are almost, they're indistinguishable from Major League Baseball itself. Nobody even knows that they're like, they think that the American League was like a separate league that was literally challenging for supremacy of Major League Baseball. And now Major League Baseball has a monopoly, whatever they call it, monopoly exemption. So now Major League Baseball is a monopoly, has no challengers, is eroding into the toilet, you know, is circling the drain, right, or is a dumpster fire heading off a cliff, however you want to describe it. And there's nobody to challenge it and to you know, whip it into shape by saying, we're going to put a better product on the field compared to you. And as a result, they're just slowly, you know, wasting away because they don't have any competition. And out of those competitions is when you see excellence start to, you know, because they have to fight back.
Yeah.
They have to fight back. They have to take on those, you know, to survive. They're either going to survive by fighting back and challenging and winning that war, or they're not, and they're going to fade away, and a superior product is going to come out of the situation.
So with this starting to charge admission in golf, in the golf evolving, where does it evolve to next? Is that where we're going to get into?
That's where we're going to go to next. I mean, what we're going to be talking about really is that Walter Hagen is going to start. There's this like sort of a phase of Walter's career where he starts going on these tours, and he's, because of his name, he is going to be, he's going to realize that like, it's not enough to go on tour and just be like, I'm Walter Hagen. And this guy here, he's also a famous person. So let's have two famous people on this tour. He's like, let's do something bigger.
Yeah.
So he's going to have this sidekick named Joe Kirkland.
Okay.
Who is not just a good golfer, but he's also a trick shot artist.
Oh, all right.
He can do all kinds of crazy. And that's something we got to look. He's got videos.
I was going to make like a Harlem Globetrotter joke, but he is a trick shot artist.
He is a trick shot artist. And so there's actually videos on YouTube that we should put together for the show, for the next week's show. There's a couple of Joe Kirkland videos because he was like such an awesome trick shot artist. Like he could he could like hit the ball on his club and then hit it backwards and like drive it farther than Hagen, like backwards and stuff. So there's all kind of like, so Hagen's going to go on the road with this guy who's like a trick shot artist, while Hagen himself is like just an overall great golfer.
Yeah.
And so he's just going to be on these tours. They're going to be traveling all over the place. We're going to be kind of digging into that a little bit. And
and then we're going to follow golf's lead. And Chris had a suggestion for us. We're going to start charging admission for the podcast, the way they're charging admission for golf now.
Well, that's what we're trying to get
to,
is charging.
We'll easily raise $1 million.
Thanks for the idea. Once we get past the double and triple digit viewership, once we get to the point where our show is must-watch TV, then we're going to be charging.
And the way we'll do that is when you subscribe. So everybody, thanks for hanging out. Thanks for listening. Subscribe. Leave a comment.
So at first it's free watching. So it's not just free. You should be looking at like, I'm getting a huge deal because people in the future are going to be paying through the nose to watch this show.
So tell a few friends. We appreciate it. And leave a comment. I love it. We got another comment from a family member.
I saw that.
So it was pretty neat. So from the Golden Circle. From the recordings that we were listening in on.
Yeah.
And so it was the daughter, I think it was the daughter of somebody, and she was like, it was so great to hear the voice.
Yeah.
And they were like, thanks for sharing that. And I'm like, it's fun when people find it and then family members find it. I want to do an episode where we, try to coordinate everybody on one night, but we should reach out to all these people and record just a little bit.
I met a ton,
and then put them together into an episode. I want to do that. All the people that have commented and kind of,
I've got a bunch of just on my Facebook like friends list. I've got people on my Facebook friends list that are families from the teams.
We should touch base with them.
I've got people that I wish I would have gotten a hold of. I wish I would have kept their numbers because I've actually got other people that I just met along the way that were like, You know, that
really
just,
connected to the story.
And I used to just bump into them so often, like when I was doing art shows, and then I just almost didn't even feel like I needed their numbers. But I'm like, maybe I should have, you know?
So that'll be fun. I want to do that as an episode. That's going to be one of my side projects is
for sure
connecting with all the people that have left comments, all the family members, and it's thanks to everybody who leaves a comment and all that stuff on the podcast. We appreciate it, and I'm gonna work on my slice, and we'll see you next time.